This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In times like these, the arc of history is often invoked to make sense of the present. The so-called Islamic State, so the narrative goes, arose in the vacuum left after America's Middle East misadventures post 9/11. And recently, John Meacham's book has been in the news for revelations that George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41, thought his son, W, 43, was badly served by Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. That's news. Especially since the narrative, if you'll recall, used to be that 43 was just doing his father's bidding, remember? Retribution for an unfinished war? The real revelation in Meacham's sweeping new book, Destiny and Power, is the light it casts both on the profound shift in American politics and the closing of a chapter of what was called the American Century. John Meacham, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Bush the Elder, as he's sometimes called, was certainly the last of a breed, in a way, a son of a New England patrician who saw public service not so much as a career, but a kind of duty. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this sort of begins to make itself manifest on his, was it the 17th birthday when he signs up for service?
It was his 18th
birthday. 18th birthday.
It was June 12th, 1942, and he graduated from high school, turned 18, and drove over to Boston from Andover to enlist in the United States Navy to become an aviator. After Pearl Harbor, he actually told me that he had considered briefly going into the Royal Canadian Air Force because you could become a pilot faster. He was a man in a hurry almost all his life, and the war shaped him deeply. Texas shaped him deeply. It's really an extraordinary saga. You look at George Bush, and sometimes you think of him as this character straight out of the Brooks Brothers catalog, but that's not quite right.
You know, Connecticut Yankee, who comes to Texas, why?
He wanted to make a lot of money. He's very honest about that. Wanted to get in the oil business. He had gone to war from 42 to 45, obviously. He had gone through Yale in 2.5 years. His son, George W., was born in 1946. He had married Barbara in 1945, and really didn't want to go to Wall Street, didn't want to take the expected path, as he put it. It just wasn't different enough, he said.
Was there something about the love of adventure that he had as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. For a man who looks as though he's this figure of history and linked to the past, he was always about the next thing. He was always about looking forward. And drove down to Odessa, stopped in Abilene for a chicken fried steak. He wasn't sure if it was chicken fried like a steak or steak fried like a chicken on his first stop. And ended up in Odessa. And Barbara's mother, in fact, thought Odessa was so uncivilized that she sent boxes of soap so that her children would be able to be clean. That's a true story. So they were in Odessa and then went to spent about a year bouncing around California, and then came back to Midland before moving to Houston in 59.
Something that is striking in your book that a lot of people don't talk about is the member of the Bush clan who never made it to adulthood.
Right. Could
you tell us a little bit about why Robin is such a factor in this book?
Well, Robin Bush was 4 years old in 1953, diagnosed with leukemia in Midland. Neither George nor Barbara Bush had ever heard the word before the diagnosis. They took her to Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, where a Bush uncle was the head of operations there. And she survived about 6 months and then died. And I asked the president what he'd learned from this, and it was a very emotional set of conversations about this. And he said that life was unpredictable and fragile. And I'm convinced that that experience, plus the World War II experience, where he lost two crewmen on a mission over Chichijima in the Bonin Islands, he became someone who believed that he had to make himself commensurate to, worthy of the loss of others.
Worthy of the loss of others.
Yeah. Why was he, as he said about the war, why was I spared? And I think he was always trying to prove to himself and to the world that he was worthy of having survived the war. And I think the fragility of life after the loss of Robin was something that kept him moving, always moving.
We're talking with John Meacham. He's the author of a new book on George Herbert Walker Bush, Destiny and Power. Before we leave the subject of Robin, there's a remarkable thing that happened when you were talking with the former president about a note that he had written to his mother.
It was in the late 1950s, and he wrote a letter to his mother about Robin.
This was several years after Robin had passed.
Probably, the best we can date is it's an undated letter. It was probably 58 or 59. And I asked him to read this out loud. I'll just read a couple of lines from it. "We need a legitimate Christmas angel, one who doesn't have cuffs beneath the dress. We need someone who's afraid of frogs. We need someone to cry when I get mad, not argue. We need a little one who can kiss without leaving egg or jam or gum. We need a girl. We had one once. She'd fight and cry and play and make her way just like the rest. But there was about her a certain softness. She was patient. Her hugs were just a little less wiggly. She'd climb in to sleep with me, and somehow she'd fit. She'd stand beside our bed till I felt her there. Silently and comfortable, she'd put those precious, fragrant locks against my chest and fall asleep. Her peace made me feel strong, and so very important. My daddy had a caress, a certain ownership, which touched a slightly different spot than the high dad I love so much. But she is still with us. We need her, and yet we have her. We can't touch her, and yet we can feel her. We hope she'll stay in our house for a long, long time." Long before he finished the letter, he broke down in physical sobs.
When he was reading this
out loud to me. And his chief of staff came in and said, "Why did you want President Bush to do that?" And I said, "Well, if you want to know someone's heart..." And before I could finish the sentence, the president interrupted and said, "You have to know what breaks it." And that's George Herbert Walker Bush. That's someone very little known, even to the country he led. But there was a sweetness and a nobility and a sensitivity. You know, Bill Clinton said he felt our pain, but George Bush really did. He just couldn't express it.
Also remarkable to me is that in public life, I think that he would be the furthest anyone would consider a sort of public poet.
Yes.
He could barely, sometimes it seemed like he could barely put a sentence together, as critics would say. And yet this is remarkable, a remarkable piece of writing.
He wrote beautifully. You know, I think one of the reasons he was inarticulate publicly is because his mind moved faster than his mouth.
Really?
I think he was a highly intelligent man. And I think he would start to make a general statement and then realize the four qualifiers that went with it. And so he would sort of interrupt himself.
So then what explains, and maybe you have some insight on this, what explains the incident with the scanner, which so many people, I mean, there are all these little caricatures.
Sure, sure. The scanner, you know, it's the Bush has pushed back hard on that. You remember, it was early 92, the recession was going on. The caricature, as you say, of Bush as an out-of-touch elitist had already taken hold. And he was at a National Grocers Association meeting, you know, what's second prize, looking at new technology. And there was a scanner that apparently read labels that had been jumbled up or torn up. Mm-hmm. And he found it, and he called it amazing. And there was a story in the New York Times about how he was just now encountering this technology. And it was a story that captured a moment brilliantly, fairly or unfairly. President Bush, by 1992, really by late 1991, was having a very hard time effectively connecting to the voters with whom he had effectively connected in 1988. His argument, this implicit argument of his campaign in 1988, was that though he had not lived life the way most of his countrymen had, he saw life in the same way. they shared values. And by 1992, that was just a harder case to make. He was living, I will say, on borrowed historical time anyway. We have not had more than 8 years of one-party rule in the White House since the Roosevelt-Truman years, mm-hmm. except for Reagan and Bush. And so there's a sense that the cycle was working against him. That would have been 16 years. It would have been like Roosevelt and Truman. Hard to hold on to the White House that long.
But anyone who remembers the difference between Bush in 88 and in 92 remembers someone who was really going for it and then someone who was reluctant. It was as if he did not want to participate in the retail politics yeah. that the times demanded.
There are a couple of factors. One was he had a thyroid condition called Graves' disease, which the treatment for which can lower your energy and your acuity levels. I think that was a factor, certainly not in fitness for office, but in enthusiasm for a campaign trail. The other was a post-Gulf War letdown. It was a despondency. He was unhappy with the way the war had ended. He believed that Saddam Hussein was going to be toppled by his own people. He did not think it had been a clean war in the sense of a battleship Missouri surrender, which is his phrase from his diary. And he had a very difficult time and, in fact, never fully re-engaged with domestic politics in the way he had in 89 and the first part of 90, where a significant number of achievements, actually, for which he gets virtually no credit.
Not the least of which, bringing about a peaceful end to the Cold War.
Well, the Cold War, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act, which is still functionally our environmental policy, the 1990 budget deal, for which he was roundly criticized by Republicans, but which set the conditions for the prosperity of the 1990s. More happened to George H.W. Bush in 4 years than happens to most presidents in eight.
But why does he matter today?
He matters today because he was the last president who truly put the country above his own short-term political interests, the budget deal being the great example. He knew he was going to get killed for this. He knew he was going to be, as he put it, dead meat. But he believed it was the right thing to do. And I sometimes say we shall not see his like again, but I hope we do. I know he hopes we do. Sometimes he's referred to as the last gentleman in American politics. And it's funny, just a couple of weeks ago I was with him, and he said he thought that was a myth, that a gentleman couldn't be in politics. But it is the exception, not the rule. And George Bush is an exceptional human being, and I believe quite a consequential president.
I have to ask, since you've visited with him recently, how is he?
He's fine. For 91, suffering from a form of Parkinson's disease that keeps him in a wheelchair, but totally follows what's going on around him, dips in and out of the conversation with witty remarks. We took him, he had a debate with my 7-year-old about how she'd lost her front tooth a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, he is a great man. He's not perfect. You know, he only won 3 elections on his own, 2 House races in Houston and the presidency of the United States. He did not appreciate the rhetorical requirements of his office. He failed to capture the imagination of the country in the way that Kennedy or Reagan did. But there is a kind of greatness in quiet heroism. And as you suggested a second ago, the Cold War ended without a shot being fired. He executed a war in the Middle East with great skill. He left the country stronger domestically than it was before, though almost no one noticed or gave him credit for at the time. And so I think if you go back and just, A, his life is just fascinating because of, you know, growing up in Greenwich, going to war, building a business in Texas, being in Congress under Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, running for the Senate down here in 1964 and 1970, being chairman of the Republican National Committee, being ambassador to the United Nations, being the envoy to China, being the director of Central Intelligence, being
amazing.
I mean, it just goes, and you can't, you know, if you wrote this life as a novel, your editor would bounce it because it was improbable. But it happened. And he was the last president who really could marshal what I think of as the all too little utilized American center. And I think that's why it matters.
Destiny and Power is the name of the sweeping book by John Meacham. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Dave.